Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the WUNC studios at the Legislative Building in downtown Raleigh, it's Friday, April 28th, 2017. I'm Jeff Tiberi, glad to have you along for this latest edition of the WUNC Politics Podcast. It was a busy week in state legislative action. It was crossover week here at the General Assembly. You can find stories and perspective about many or some of the 250 bills that moved this week at our website, WUNC.org. However, for today on the podcast, we will turn our attention largely away from North Carolina matters, or at least North Carolina legislative matters. And we say hello to a senior reporting fellow at ProPublica. Jessica Hoosman is on the line from New York. Hey there, Jessica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Let's start with just your latest story. What are you working on right now, or what came out this week? What's going on in your professional world?
Right. So I cover voting largely for ProPublica. So all things voting rights, redistricting, election administration. And so I am working on getting out a story on Texas's voter ID law, which has been a legal headache for that state since 2011. And that will come out on Tuesday with the Texas Tribune. Very excited about that. But in recent weeks, I've also been covering everything from, the upcoming redistricting Supreme Court case that's going to deal with Wisconsin, but will probably have far-reaching implications than that, even in North Carolina, and then also a little bit of hate crimes. So it's kind of everywhere.
Good little hodgepodge right there.
Yeah.
So in terms of Texas, and we'll transition to North Carolina's proposed voting law, it's been struck down here in a minute. In terms of Texas, what's at the heart of this? What's at the crux of what's going on?
Right. So Texas's voter ID law, when it was passed in 2011, was the most strict voter ID law in the entire country. So it allowed only seven forms of very strict Texas or federally issued IDs and made almost no exceptions to that rule. They offered free election identification cards that could only be used for elections that you could get at the Department of Motor Vehicles, which is run in the state of Texas by a law enforcement agency called the Department of Public Safety. But they did not make the underlying documentation that you needed to apply for those IDs, like birth certificates, free. So the IDs weren't actually free. And so all of that has led to, 6 years of legal battles. It was first held up by the Department of Justice under preclearance, but after the Shelby County decision in 2013, that preclearance step was not necessary, and Texas put its voter ID law into full effect without making the changes that the Department of Justice recommended that it make. And so they were immediately sued, and they've been in court with that law ever since. And in the couple of months leading up towards the November election, they struck a compromise allowing people who didn't have photo ID to sign an affidavit and present an alternate form of non-photo ID. But it was so close to the 2016 election that election administrators didn't really know how to implement the compromise, and no one really knew how to comply with the law. So it was a lot of chaos and confusion on election day trying to implement this law with so little lead-up time.
Interesting, and definitely some similarities to North Carolina. Before we shift to here, with what's going on in Texas, I mean, is it entirely along party lines? Are there Republicans who are opposed to what has moved through and transpired, or is this really an R versus a D deal?
You know, it really is an R versus a D situation. And, you know, I've, in the course of reporting out this story, I've talked to several Republicans who were once in the state House or the state Senate who are looking on this bill with a lot of animosity, but they are no longer in the state House. What they tell me is that in 2010, Texas elected into office a supermajority of Republicans to the point where it was not necessary for them to make any compromises at all in the voter ID bill that they wanted. And so while there were far more soft bills in 2005, 2007, and 2009 offered up on the state floor that would have allowed for many more forms of ID and many more exceptions and exemptions to the rules, all of those were torpedoed by Democrats who held far more power during that time. But in 2010, when Republicans rode that Tea Party wave in and they elected a supermajority, they slammed through a bill that was incredibly harsh. And so Republicans who left office or who were voted out for being too moderate during that time tell me that they do not agree with the bill, but unfortunately they're not the ones in office. And Texas has now spent millions of dollars, somewhere around $5 million, defending this bill, and they have never won, even in front of the Fifth Circuit, which is the most conservative appeals court in the country. They lost, and this bill was found to be discriminatory.
So in terms of motivations, is this falling under the guise of protecting voters from fraud? Is it something else that has been used as a rationale for why this bill was enacted and why it is being defended to the tune of $5 million?
Right. So, you know, there is very little fraud of the type that this bill could prevent. Reasonably, the only type of fraud that this bill could prevent is somebody impersonating someone else to cast a single ballot in person at the polls. It cannot prevent mail-in ballot fraud. It cannot prevent absentee ballot fraud. It cannot prevent a lot of other types of election fraud that are reasonably common. And, you know, the Texas governor, Greg Abbott, when he was attorney general, launched a effort to combat what he said was statewide rampant voter fraud. And he spent more than $3 million trying to find voter fraud and only found two cases out of 20 million ballots that could have reasonably been prevented by voter ID. And even in one of those cases, the woman had a fake driver's license. So it's not clear that that could have been prevented either. And so, you know, what folks are telling me is that this is not so much to prevent fraud as it is to perpetrate a sort of line that Democrats are fine with voter fraud, that Democrats want illegal immigrants to be able to vote, and illegal immigrants are voting, and we should stop that because Democrats want them to. So as long as Republicans can convince people that voter fraud is happening and that voter fraud is a rampant problem when it is in fact not, then that's a good political position to be in. You know, in the state of Texas, there are only about 600,000 people that lack the type of ID necessary to get to the polls, 600,000 registered voters. And that seems like a lot, but in a state as big as Texas, that's actually really only a small fraction of registered voters. So it's not really enough to swing an election for the Republicans. But that message that they can send, that Democrats are okay with voter fraud, that Democrats want non-citizens to be able to vote, is a really powerful message, and one that voters really respond to, because it does seem to them like there might be this massive swing of voter fraud, even though there's not. They're being misled.
I was sitting here during the first part of your answer thinking about messaging in my head and just the word messaging, and then you hit on it twice. But just as we've seen with healthcare and on a more local level here in North Carolina, I think with the framing of how education is in the state, where the funding for education is going and coming from, and how successful classrooms are being. I mean, this is the intersection of politics and policy, and the messaging is so key. It's really interesting, just as a side. So you're hitting on some of the buzzwords, right? I mean, supermajority. That's the case here in North Carolina with both chambers of the state legislature. Shelby, the famous case that the Supreme Court heard or decided and ruled on in 2013. And when preclearance went away, we'll transition now to North Carolina. Afterward, lawmakers here enacted a bill, and they did so pretty quickly. It was initially a voter ID bill that mandated photo identification at the polls for North Carolina voters, reduced early voting, and did away with same-day registration, among other provisions. It was very controversial. It moved quickly. That is something that eventually has been very much rolled back almost entirely. The voter ID provision went away at the hands of lawmakers a year or 2 years later. And then much of the rest of the law was ruled unconstitutional by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond. The defendants have appealed, and they've appealed up to the Supreme Court. And as we record on this Friday, that case is in conference at the Supreme Court for, I believe, the third time. Perhaps we will learn something as early as Monday about whether the court is going to take the case or send it back down. I mean, they could do a number of different things with it. But as we talk about North Carolina and Texas, are there other states that come to mind? Are there other challenges? Speak to the extent that you can, this being part of a larger swing or movement or trend.
Right. So, you know, there are voting rights issues that are popping up all across the state that I'm sure that the Supreme Court will be dealing with pretty quickly. You know, there's most notably, I think, there is a case that's come out of Wisconsin that said there that the Republican legislature so gerrymandered their House districts so as to be unconstitutional and violate this idea of one person, one vote. And that's going to go before the Supreme Court. And that harkens back to a lot of what's happening in North Carolina, for example. You know, I know that the maps there were drawn such that there are, 10 state Republican districts and 3 Democratic House seats. And the state representative who did that said he did that because he didn't think it was possible to draw a map with 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats. So in North Carolina especially, it is overtly political, this gerrymandering that's happening. And the Supreme Court has dealt with these issues before, but they've never sort of drawn a fine line between when redistricting needs to stop being political and when it needs to, you know, when that bright line is crossed. So in 1962, they decided that, you know, there was a case that led to the principle of one person, one vote, and the Voting Rights Act explicitly forbids redistricting that's racial in nature, but it doesn't say anything about gerrymandering that is partisan in nature, and the Supreme Court has frowned upon gerrymandering that's extremely partisan, but they've never addressed it to such an extent that a legal rule has been created, like the one in 1962 where they established one person, one vote. So it's very possible that in this circumstance that could be dealt with, which would have interesting repercussions for quite a lot of states. So North Carolina's gerrymandering issues are still at issue in the federal courts. Texas's certainly are. Just last week, they decided that a federal appeals court in Texas decided that the congressional districts or that the House districts there had been drawn through intentional discrimination several weeks before they decided that the congressional districts were drawn with intentional discrimination. So this is a case that would have pretty far-reaching impacts. And, you know, all the political and legal commentators that I've spoken to about Texas's voter ID law fully expect that to be appealed up to the Supreme Court, because unlike in North Carolina, where you had legislators willing to roll that voter ID law back, you don't have that motivation at all in Texas. And it's fully expected that Ken Paxton, who's the attorney general there, and Greg Abbott, who's now the governor and was once attorney general, have every intention of appealing this out all the way to the end, because they are looking for a Supreme Court ruling that tells them that the way that they wrote their voter ID law is perfectly constitutional, which may honestly be the case now that Gorsuch is on the Supreme Court. So, you know, you've got a lot of voting cases that will likely percolate up to the Supreme Court in at least the next year that could have pretty far-reaching impacts for the type of moves that Republicans across the country have been doing. I mean, we're talking about a country now where Republicans control the legislature in 33 states, and that has happened gradually, and they've been passing bills like this across the country.
One potentially quick follow-up. In your reporting, have you come across any legal challenges of gerrymandering when the maps were drawn by Democratic lawmakers?
You know what? I haven't. I mean, this has been an ongoing kind of issue. And one thing that Ari Berman of The Nation wrote a really excellent book called Give Us the Ballot. And he kind of spells out the history of redistricting under the Voting Rights Act, and the way that these district lines are drawn. And I think that, you know, it's hard to gerrymander in a way that would like inherently benefit minorities in a way that the Voting Rights Act would not necessarily allow, or at least it hasn't been done yet. Federal courts have looked far more kindly on opportunity districts for minorities that allow minorities to get minority representatives into office than they have with hyper-partisan redistricting that forces minorities out of office or makes it far more difficult for minorities to get elected. And so we haven't reached that point yet, nor do I think that there have ever been redistricting moves that have been as explicit as some of the things that you see going on in Texas and North Carolina. And so, you know, it hasn't happened yet. That's not to say that it won't happen in the future. But no, I haven't come across it.
Okay, fair enough. Jessica Hoosman is a senior reporting fellow at ProPublica. She's the guest, your guest, on the WUNC Politics podcast this week. One of the things I like to ask people when they come on the podcast is to tell us a little bit about their news consumption. What is your ebb and flow? Where do you go to read, listen, watch, and just take in your current events?
Right. So I am, you know, fortunately, I've had several people in the last several months ask me, you know, what my recommendation is for how they should start consuming news. And my recommendation, which I follow, is that I subscribe to one magazine, one national paper, and one local paper that kind of propels me forward. And I subscribe to a few more, but my mainstays, I love the Texas Monthly. I think that is an amazing magazine. It's full of real news and really beautifully written narrative pieces. I subscribe to the Washington Post because I think their national coverage is some of the best in the country. And then I also, because it's my local paper, subscribe to the New York Times. But, you know, I try to keep up with other papers across the country, too. So I really love the L.A. Times and the Dallas Morning News and the Houston Chronicle. And then the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is also very excellent. So those are the papers that I go most frequently to. But my mainstays are the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Texas Tribune.
What about a guilty pleasure? Perhaps something on Twitter or what about a guilty pleasure?
Oh, goodness. You know, I love BuzzFeed. I know that's such a crazy thing to say, but I think that their coverage is hilarious and it's spot on. And then on the flip side, BuzzFeed has really lately invested really heavily in their investigative team. And so BuzzFeed, shockingly for some people, I think, has some of the best investigative reporters in the country working for them. And so it's a funny place to go to get everything from, you know, listicles with funny pictures of cats to a really deep investigation into a national mental hospital. So that's, you know, when I'm bored, that's where I go.
You've been with ProPublica for about a year. Prior to that, you made stops, journalism stops at other locations, but you also, in this life, but in a previous career, were a high school history teacher in Newark, New Jersey. I have a number of questions, but
okay.
I guess you, let me start with, I'll keep it to two things. One, what is your favorite era of history and why? And two, what, if anything, that you learned as your time as a history teacher benefits you today as a reporter?
Sure. So, you know, I really loved teaching my kids. I know this is going to sound crazy. I really loved teaching my kids about philosophy, about social contract theory from John Locke and Rousseau and Hobbes, and having them debate the differences between those things and compare them and make that, you know, very old political philosophy relevant to today. And having them kind of work through the logic of those things was really rewarding, I think, for them. And then it was also fascinating for me as a teacher to see a 14-year-old kid from Newark decide whether or not he agreed with the social contract theory and, you know, Leviathan or two treatises on government. So, you know, it was a really rewarding thing to see. And I think that people forget that our current political structure is based largely on political theory that was written, you know, 350 years ago in many cases. So that was great to see. And I enjoyed those discussions. But, you know, one of the things that that I continue to think about when I'm a reporter now that I spent those years in Newark teaching high school history is that, you know, I think reporters forget a lot of the time that you have to meet people where they are. And I think reporters have this really interesting way of forgetting their role in what's going on in current matters. You know, we are outraged every single day by the people who believe fake news, or the people who think that we're lying to them all the time, or the people who ignore the lies that politicians tell them. But we don't take a minute to look in the mirror and ask ourselves how or what we're doing to cause that, or at least not to prevent it. And I think something that teachers have to do every day is it doesn't really matter why your kids don't understand what's going on. It doesn't really matter why your kids, you know, or like that your kids failed a test. What matters is that you have to take responsibility for that and make them learn in a different way or communicate with them differently so that they do understand. And I think a lot of the time journalists are so entrenched in these traditions of reporting the news in the way that they've always reported it that they don't take a step back to wonder if the way that they're communicating the news is ineffective. And I think that if they were to approach that question like teachers do, that maybe we could communicate with people in different ways. So, you know, one of the things that ProPublica has started doing, which I think is actually pretty effective, is to radically change the way that we relate to our readers on social media. So instead of writing quick, short breaking news pieces to fact check something that, you know, frankly, most people will never read, we're addressing falsehoods immediately when they come out on Twitter. So we're bringing news to the platforms people are already on, and we're reporting news direct to social media. And that's been a huge shift. We've gotten a lot of coverage for it, far more than I actually expected. You know, we've had write-ups done in the Columbia Journalism Review and in Nieman Lab for this weird way we're bringing the news to people. But it doesn't seem that weird to me at all, because that's really where people are consuming the news these days, is on social media. And so we need to shift the way that we're communicating with our audience. And so I think that being able to take a step back and ask myself what I'm doing wrong is the most important thing that I took away from teaching.
ProPublica recently won a Pulitzer. Tell me about that moment when you found out.
Oh my goodness, that was really amazing. You know, I think here's a funny secret, is that the Pulitzer is kind of, especially if you are in a newsroom in which you won, you're like, no one is supposed to know until they announce it, but it's kind of the worst kept secret ever. Because, you know, we walked into the office that day and we had this email saying, oh, there's someone from the Pulitzer office here taking photos, you know, never mind why. And we were all kind of, there was like a little whisper that went around the office. But there's, you know, I mean, I watched the folks. I wasn't really involved in the project that won the Pulitzer at all, but I watched them. It was a partnership that we did with Sarah Riley, who's a just fantastic reporter who was at the New York Daily News at the time and is now at The Trace covering guns. But I watched her and three or four reporters at ProPublica here work on that story for almost a year, traveling all over the state and all over the country to do this reporting. And it was really just such a labor of love for them. They got so passionate about this story, and they were working harder than I've ever seen reporters work. And, you know, the moment that we won that award, I think it was just so nice to see all of that hard work pay off for those reporters. You know, when Sarah Riley, because she was not a ProPublica employee, she was a New York Daily News employee, was with the New York Daily News when it was announced, but she came to our office just a few minutes after, and there was just this extended round of applause for her and the reporters that she worked with at ProPublica. And it was just really nice to see. I think, you know, sometimes journalism can be really, really thankless. People, you know, especially now, there's not the greatest tone around journalism in the world. And we have a president in office who repeatedly says how much he disrespects journalists. So it's nice to kind of to take a step back and, like, be happy about your work for a day. But, you know, it's ProPublica, and we have these very dedicated reporters. So it was kind of funny to see this crazy celebration for a few minutes, and then half an hour later, everyone was back at their desks working on their projects again. So it was a few minutes of really excellent celebration and joy, and then everything was back to normal.
Back to the grind.
Yeah.
You can read Jessica's work and her colleagues at ProPublica.org. Jessica Huseman is a senior reporting fellow at ProPublica. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
That'll do it for this edition. Share the episode on social media, Facebook, Twitter, elsewhere. If you would like, subscribe as well on Google Play, Stitcher, and iTunes. And you can find all the latest North Carolina political stories at our website, wunc.org. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Enjoy your weekend. From Birmingham.